Okay, so here we are in chapter 10. And if you recall back in chapter 9, it's been a couple of weeks, right? Because we missed last week.
We went back to 3.
Yeah, we went all the way back to 3. Was it 3 or 4? Okay. In chapter 9 was God's promise to Noah. And we looked at the rainbow. That was the covenant that God made, the rainbow, which was a sign of war, but God made it into a sign of peace. And this is where Noah left the ark, him and his three sons, and then he planted a vineyard, and then he drank, and then he got
drunk.
Okay, good. After he got drunk, he was revealed, and after that, his son came in and saw him. And the name of the son that saw him was, well, there's three of them. There was Shem, Ham, and Japheth. It was Ham. Good job.
Japheth was it.
Yeah. So Ham was the one that saw him and went and told his two brothers. So Japheth and Shem went in, or Shem and Japheth went in, and they covered their father, right? And then their dad pronounced a blessing on the two brothers and a curse on Canaan, which was the son of Ham. And then tonight we're in chapter 10, looking at the nations who are descended from Noah. And these first 11 chapters of Genesis are very important because they explain the beginning of everything. These first 11 chapters explain the beginning of everything. The beginning of creation, the beginning of marriage and family, the beginning of sin, the beginning of the gospel. Can anyone tell me where the beginning of the gospel was? What chapter? Chapter something of Genesis. Chapter... Good job. Chapter 3 and verse 15, it talks about the promise of the coming Messiah. And here also in the first few chapters of Genesis, we just finished looking at the flood and then the various languages and the locations. And so here in chapter 10, we come to what's called the repopulation of the earth, or the table of nations. So after the flood, how many people were on the earth?
Eight
people, right? Okay, good. Only eight people. And so chapter 10 is going to explain how the planet was repopulated and where they settled. So all peoples are direct descendants of who? Of Noah. Good job. We're going to keep answering all the right questions, right? And then say, just kidding, when we make a mistake. Okay. So in this 10th chapter of Genesis, it stands absolutely alone when it comes to ancient literature. Nothing else even comes close when it begins to describe to us what actually happened in the events that took place at that time. Okay? It's the only accurate source of this period to explain to us. This is how we understand the various cultures of people and their geographies after the flood. And without this record in chapter 10, it would be a mystery to us. Nothing else even comes close in all of literature. So, who is the author here? Who's the author? Of course, God. But who did he use? He used Moses, right? To write to us the first five books. And so Moses here is the author, and he's giving an account of history. And so what we're going to do as we go through this at the very end, we're going to consider three things. Number one, we're going to consider that God is above all nations. Secondly, we're going to look at Nimrod, who's a picture of those who are looking to set up an earthly kingdom. We'll talk about Nimrod for a little bit. And then finally, there's 70 people that are mentioned in this genealogy. And yes, it's a list of name after name after endless name again. And sometimes you look at that and you go, that's the most challenging chapter. And it is challenging. It's very challenging. And it's even more challenging to teach it. But you know what? There's always truths that need to be extracted from every chapter in the Bible. Nothing is there by accident. Nothing is there for us to just skip over. Let's just go to chapter 9 and then chapter 11 and then all the good chapters. No. This is an important one for us to go through and understand the 70 people that are mentioned. And the reason why Moses is explaining this to them is because unless the people of Israel, who had just left Egypt, yes? So I want you to picture this. They had just left Egypt, and they are now with Moses in the wilderness, right? So he's writing this to them in the wilderness, and unless they understand their history, they are bound to repeat it. Unless we understand history, unless we understand our history and the history of humanity, we are bound to repeat it because history always repeats itself. And so we will end up making the same mistake over and over and over again. So there are warnings, clues, helpful hints and insights in these things. And so here in chapters 10 and 11 is the bridge between what happened after the flood to the patriarchs, which is Abraham. So beginning in verse 1. There we go. Beginning in verse 1. By the way, I found this online. I didn't create this myself, just so you know. I'm not that good. So now this is the genealogy of the sons of Noah. Shem, Ham, and Japheth. These were the sons born to him after the flood. And so from these three sons, the whole world then was populated. Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Now, under Shem, there's going to be 26 names that are mentioned. Under Ham, there's going to be 30 names that are mentioned. Under Japheth, 14. When you add those up, we come to a number, 70. Right? So that becomes very, very important as we look at the end of this study here. These were the three sons. And so Moses will speak of Japheth first, then of Ham, and then leaving the pathway for Shem, which will then usher the way for the patriarchs, which, of course, is the lineage of Abraham. So the sons of Japheth, he begins with here in verse 2, the sons of Japheth were Gomer, not Gomer Pyle, for those of you who are familiar with older TV, Magog, Madai, Javan, Tubal, Meshech, and Teres. So, early in the history of the world, the Japhethites, sometimes referred to as the Aryans, split into two groups. Okay. Now, one group settled in India, and I'll show you a map here in a minute, in India, and the other group in Europe. And together they formed what is known as the Indo-European family of nations. This is going to be kind of interesting because you'll get to find out which of these great-grandfathers you actually belong to from the country that you come from. Arise International Church. We all don't come from one particular father, but we probably have different fathers, but we're all cousins in the end. That's one thing for sure. So they are all called the Indo-European family of nations. And the Greeks say that their ancestors' man name was Japatos, very close to Jephthah. And they regarded him not only as the father of the race, but the father of all of humanity. The Indians, on the other hand, have an account after the flood, similar to all aspects of the biblical account, and the hero in there has three sons. The oldest name was Iaipeti, very close to Jephthah, and the other two were Sharma and Kaharma, close to Shem and Ham as well. And so in the Indian account, Kaharma, or Ham, was cursed by his father because he laughed at him when he got drunk. If you recall a few weeks ago when we looked at this, we talked about how many cultures have similar stories of the flood, and we broke it down by percentages. It's just mind-boggling. Gomer, his descendants were the people of Western Europe. This included the original French, Spanish, and Celtic settlers. Then there's Magog, Tubal, and Meshech. There we go. Let's see if I can do this. Ooh, look at that. I just had to use it, yeah. And these settled far north in Europe and became the Russian people. And Meshach is the old word used for what is known today as Moscow. So Magog, you've heard of Gog and Magog. That refers to the people of the north, and that refers to Russia. So that becomes important later on when you study the book of Ezekiel, and then you go on to Revelations, and they talk about Gog and Magog, and the beast coming, and so on and so forth. That's what it refers to, and I'll show you again a map here in a moment. Now, the Russians were enemies with the Chinese, and we'll see why, because the map in current day is very, very close. The Russians and the Chinese. So much so that when the Chinese decided to build the Great Wall of China, they built it to keep the Russians out. So I did a little bit of research on the Great Wall of China. Does anyone have a close guess as to how long the Great Wall of China is? Huh? The Great Wall of China. Any idea? 21,196 kilometers. That comes to about 13,170 miles. 13,000 miles. How many miles from here to New York? About three, right? 13,170 miles of the Great Wall of China. They really wanted to keep those people out. Don't come here. So, Medai or Madai, from one of the sons of Jephthah, is where we get the Medes from today, which current day is Iran, Iraq, that particular area. And the peoples of India also came from the branch of the Jephthah family, and Javan, which is from the original Greeks. Javan. Where's Javan? There he is, right there. Now, verse 3. The sons of Gomer were Ashkenaz, Riphath, and Togarmah. The oldest son of Gomer was Ashkenaz. So he and his descendants first settled around the Black Sea and then moved north into the land which is called Ascensia, which later became known as the islands of Scandia, which we know today as Scandinavia. All right, and Togarmah became the Armenians. Anyone know where Armenia existed? Just to the right of Turkey. Wherever Turkey is on the map, a little bit to the right, that's where Armenia is. And the sons of Javan were Elisha, Tarshish. Tarshish, have we heard that word before? Tarshish? Yeah. There's a person who had a whale of a time trying to find Tarshish. Anyone know his name? Jonah. Sorry. Saul of Tarsus. Tarshish, Tarsus. Yeah, and from these, the coastland peoples. And from these then came the nations of the earth. And so this map then becomes really helpful, and it's color-coded. The descendants of Japheth are in the green. The descendants of Ham, they're in the orange. And then on the bottom, in the purple, are the descendants of Shem. And these are the places where they initially settled and then eventually continued to broaden out. And these sons of Japheth found their way around the world, and they became the great colonizers of the world. And most of the world's population today are from the sons of Japheth.
I have a question.
Sure.
I don't know if it's going to come up later. So once they split, and that's where they start going.
In chapter 11, they will split. So this is kind of giving us the preview as to what's going to happen as chapter 11. They have not gone there just yet, but this is giving us a history of the peoples and where they went. And then in chapter 11, it's going to tell us how they went.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. So remember in the prophecy, God said Japheth's tents will be enlarged. And so they were truly enlarged, and God blessed them and caused them to occupy most of the world's land. And so Europe, Eastern Europe and Western Europe, they went east and west all the way to India across to Russia. So those are the sons of Japheth. And then in verse 6, it talks about the sons of Ham. This is son number 2. The sons of Ham, who were Cush, Mizraim, Put, and then Canaan. Now, Ham, the descendants of Ham, are the peoples who populated Africa and the Middle East. Ham. Here's Africa, and this is considered here the Middle East, in this particular area, right here. Now, Cush apparently had this family divided into two branches. Some founded Babylon over here in this area, there, and the other part founded Ethiopia, which is down south over here. So you'll see Cush down over in this area, south of Egypt. Yes. Yes. Anyone know what Mizraim is? Don't answer. Anyone know who Mizraim is? Or what country Mizraim is?
Egypt.
Of course. Hey, look at that. Good job. Misr or Mizraim is Egypt. And so put or foot, P-H-U-T, refers to Libya and the region around. This is current modern-day Libya here. And Canaan refers to those who are settling in what is currently known as Palestine, where Israel currently resides right now. So when God said, you will cross over the Red Sea and you will inherit the Promised Land, the land of the Philistines, the land of Canaan, this is the land here that was promised to the people of Israel. Now, the sons of Cush were Seba, Havilah, Sapta, Ramah, and Saptica. And the sons of Ramah were Sheba and Dedan. And Cush begot Nimrod, and he began to be a mighty one on the earth, and he was a mighty hunter before the Lord. Therefore it is said, like Nimrod, the mighty hunter before the Lord. If you're in chapter 10, you can follow along. And the beginning of his kingdom was Babel, Erech, Akkad, Calneh, and the land of Shinar. And from that land he went to Assyria and built Nineveh. So after Babylon, he built Nineveh. And Rehoboth, Calah, Rezin between Nineveh and Calah, that is the principal city. So it talks about Cush here, who begot Nimrod, a mighty one on the earth, but not in a good way. He wasn't mighty in a good way. He ruled over Babel or Babylon, which is the first organization rebellion of humans against God, because Nimrod means let us rebel. Mitnamrad. Namrud. Nimrod means let us rebel, to rebel. So he was a mighty hunter before the Lord who was rebelling, and the Jewish Talmud helps us understand this better, saying that he is a hunter of the souls of men. He wasn't just a hunter of wild animals, but he was a hunter of the souls of men. So the context then shows us that he is not that this is not a compliment of Nimrod, the idea that Nimrod was an offense to the Lord. He was offensive to God. He was a hunter of men, being a warrior. And after building the four initial cities that we just read, that wasn't sufficient for him. He had to go and build four more cities. The more that people try to acquire in this life, it's never enough. The more they try to get and accomplish and gain and retain, it's never sufficient. And the famous saying goes, when they asked the richest man on earth, I think it was Rockefeller at the time, they said, how much is enough? And his answer was, just a little bit more. It's never enough. Give me $10,000 today, I'll be very, very happy. But after a while, I'll say, I need a little bit more. Give me $1 million today, I'll be very, very, very happy. But a little while later, I'll be like, well, now I want $2 million. Give me $100 million, I'll say, I want $1 billion. It's never enough. The heart is never satisfied with the things of this world. And this is what we see happening here with this particular man. Now, here's an interesting thing about Nimrod that we need to know that will tie into the rest of our Old Testament teachings, is that he was married to a woman named Semiramis. Nimrod was married to a woman named Semiramis. Now, Semiramis claimed to have miraculous conception after Nimrod died. And after he died, she claimed that he became the sun god, called him Marduk. I know I'm losing you a little bit. That's okay. After he died, and she claimed that he was a god, she said, I am pregnant with child. And she named that child Tammuz. Guess what his birthday is? It's in December. December 25th. December 25th is the birthday of this child. In the spring, he was out about in the fields, and legend has it that he was gored to death by a wild animal, by a wild boar, and he died. And she claimed 3 days later that he resurrected. And so they had a festival or a feast, a holiday in his honor. And guess what that holiday is called? Ishtar. Ishtar eventually became Easter. And they celebrated that holiday for generations. And it flooded the Babylonian area and territory, and it became a very, very strong and powerful kind of religion. And so this mother and child combination became a cult. And so this was the central character of the religion of Babylon, the worship of the mother with the child who supposedly was virgin birthed. So you can see the clever attempt on the part of Satan to anticipate what was about to happen to try and discredit what happened. So the question is then, wait a minute, what about December 25th? Don't we celebrate Jesus' birthday on December 25th? That didn't happen until the year 327 by an emperor named Constantine. The disciples, the early church, they didn't have something called Easter, Resurrection Day. They didn't have that. They didn't have December 25th and Christmas. That's not in the Bible. That came 300 plus years later after the fact, when Constantine took off the papacy, because he took off the emperor's clothes, if you will, and put on the papacy clothes, said, we no longer can fight these Christians. We need to join these Christians, because the more we fight them, the more we kill them, the more they grow. And so he made Christianity the official religion of the Empire of Rome. And said, let's take all these pagan things and Christianize them. Let's take this huge deal of December 25th and let's make that Jesus' official birthday. So it became December 25th. So for the record, Jesus was not born on December 25th. Okay? So why do we celebrate on December 25th? Anybody have any thoughts on that? Anybody have any ideas? Why do we still celebrate on December 25th? Because we can celebrate it every day. One person honors one day above the rest. To another person, all days are the same. Let each person be convinced in his own mind. It's okay. It doesn't matter if we celebrate December 25th, January 1st, March 15th. It doesn't matter. It doesn't really matter. What we're trying to do as believers is allow the light of Christ to shine from our lives and not worry about dates and times and seasons and festivals. That's not the point. That's not the issue. If that day is going to cause people to come in and hear the gospel, so be it. It doesn't really matter at that point. This particular religion, you'll find it in the Egyptian culture, and they're labeled as Isis and Osiris. Isis and Osiris. In the Greek culture, you've heard of Venus and Adonis. Have you heard of any of these names? In Hindu, it's Ushas and Vishnu. And Jeremiah speaks of this, where the Israelites were warned against offering sacrifices to the Queen of Heaven, Semiramis. She was known as the Queen of Heaven, the wife of Nimrod, mother of this cult child. And the Lord asked them a question, why do you weep for Tammuz? The Lord is asking the people of Israel that. He's saying, why did you acquire on this foreign god, these foreign religions, and why are you weeping for Tammuz? And he names him by name. He's saying, you've left God, you've left the true faith, you've left your true identity, and you are being plagued by things that are outside of the culture. And you are living in that. He's saying, come out from among them and be separate. Don't be so engrossed in it that it completely captures you. Unfortunately, this cult, as I mentioned earlier, has crept into the church, the Roman Catholic Church especially, where the mother and the child are worshipped as joint redeemers, co-redeemers. Mary is worshipped as something that is just like so above this world. Listen, we honor Mary. We thank God for her and for her life. But I cannot worship anyone other than the Lord. When she came to Jesus and said they ran out of wine, what did he say to her? Woman, what do I have to do with you? What do I have to do with you? Like, this is none of my business. Right? What did she say to them? whatever he tells you to do, do that. In other words, turn the focus back completely on the Lord, on Jesus himself. So a little bit of history there pertaining to this man named Nimrod, or the man named Rebellion. Verse 13, Mizraim begot Ludim, Anamim, Lehabim, Nephtahim. Please pardon these names. Paphrasim, Casluhim, from whom the Philistines and the Kaphratim came. And Canaan begot Sidon, his firstborn, and Heth, the Jebusite, the Amorite, the Girgashite, the Hivite, the Arkite, the Sinite, the Arvidite, the Samarite, the Hamathite, after the families of the Canaanites were dispersed on the border of Canaan, as far as Sidon, as you go towards Gerar, as far as Giza, then as far as, go down towards Sodom and Gomorrah, Adma, Zubim, as far as Lasha. So Canaan begot Sidon. Sidon. Can anyone see? Where is Sidon? Right about there. Right about. Right. Right about there. You've heard of Tyre and Sidon? Tyre and Sidon? That's the name of modern-day Lebanon. And Heth is the father of the Hittite nations. You've heard of the Hittites? And certain of the Hittites migrated eastward into China. Also, the name of this list, the Sinites, is linked to the Chinese people. The Sinites, or Sin, not sin as in rebellion, but sin, the name, is linked to the Chinese people, which migrated eastward until they came to the western China, and they founded the Empire of China and gave their name to their land. So there's a connection there. Whoop, forgot all about this. Anyhow, there's a connection here between China. If you see China right here, this is current modern-day Russia here. Now, here is Alaska right there. And that's very, very important because they pushed eastward towards the north to bridge over Alaska. So the Sinites are the people who settled in the Americas in prehistoric days and came to be the ancestors of the Eskimos and the Indians. So we were down here in the previous map. These people, the sons of Ham, they pushed forward this way. They continued to climb this way. They went over the Bering Strait this way into Alaska, and they became the Eskimos and the Indians. These are all sons of Ham. So if you belonged to that clan, then we are cousins. That would be nice to know. Now, the sons of Shem, Elam, Ashur, Araxaphad, Lud, and Aram, these are children born to Shem, the father of Eber, whose word comes from, whose word is Hebrew. Eber, the sons of Eber, the Hebrew word Eber means to cross over, and it means Hebrew. Eber and Hebrew is the same thing. If you ever questioned and thought, where do they get the word Hebrew from? That Abraham was a Hebrew. It came from the fact that his great-grandfather was Eber. That's the name. That's the derivative of the name. And it means crossing over. Because when Abraham left Ur of the Chaldeans, he crossed over. As the children of Israel left Egypt into the promised land, they crossed over. So the name means crossing over. And the sons of Shem and Elam, Ashur, Araxaphad, Lud, and Aram. Elam was the ancestor to the Persian people. Ashur, who was the father of the Assyrians. You've heard of the Assyrians. And Aram was the father of the Arameans. Not Armenians, but the Arameans. These are all ancient people. They're also known as the Syrians. And Araxaphad was the ancestor to Abram and the Hebrews. Now, the sons of Aram were Uz, Hul, Gether, and Mash. Uz, later in the region, became the Arab people. And has anyone heard the place of Uz before in the Bible? Uz. There was a man. Who?
Uz.
No. The location is Uz. Job chapter 1. there was a man named Job who lived in the land of Uz. U-Z. Job chapter 1, verse 1. The land of Uz. So then Araxaphat begat Salah, and Salah begat Eber. Eber was the firstborn, two sons. The name of the first was Peleg, for in his day the earth was divided. So all these were the sons of this person in Joktan. The names under the son of Joktan, Eber, Salah, and Araxaphat are all associated with the Arabic people. And Jobab is probably an Old Testament term for Job himself in this particular section. Now, these were the sons of Shem according to their families, according to their languages and their lands, according to their nations. And these were the families of the sons of Noah according to their generation in their nations, from these nations were divided on the face of the earth. Interesting. Interesting. So from one little area, where they landed on Mount Ararat, was spread all over the earth. One family brought about all the families on the earth. And so it brings three important points for us to consider, as I mentioned to you at the beginning. The first of which is God is above all nations. And he's the one that determines their times and their places and their boundaries and habitation. According to Acts chapter 17, verse 26, which says, and he made from one blood every nation of man to dwell on the face of the earth, and he has determined their pre-appointed times and their boundaries of their dwelling. Listen, despite our external differences, we all belong to the same human family, and there is no nation or race superior to another. And I wish the people who use the scriptures to justify back in the day slavery would have really considered this part. Because they said the people of Ham are the people that dwelt in Africa, and Ham was cursed by God, and so Ham had dark colored skin, and so they justified the white man subjecting the darker skinned man or the black man, saying the Bible said so. Who are we to argue with God? Which wasn't the case. Because it wasn't the people of Egypt or Libya that were cursed, it was the people of Canaan that were cursed. And Canaan did not live in Africa. They are not dark-skinned people whatsoever. They are the people who are olive-skinned, who are currently residing in the region of, or who used to reside in the current region of, Israel. Canaan. Jordan, Damascus, Beirut, and so forth, in that particular area. And so there is no race that is superior to another. And God has a purpose for every nation to fulfill. Listen, also, my dwelling, my location has been designed on purpose by God. Your dwelling, your place of birth, where you currently are living, has been designed by God on purpose. My family, my heritage is in the plan of God. Before I knew this, before I understood this, sometimes the question would raise in my mind, why was I born at this time? Like, it would have been so cool to be born around the time of Jesus. Like to see him, maybe be one of his disciples. I don't know, something, right? Or why was I born into this family? Like, couldn't you find a different family for me to be born into? Or why this, or what? Listen, this makes it very clear. God has arranged and designed the places of our dwelling. Location has been predetermined by the Lord. It's in his plan. A divine design by the great architect is in place, and there is no accident with God. You are here by design. Where you were born is by design. Your DNA is by design. Your family is by design. Your history is by design. Where you currently live is by design. We should have told that to our girls when we were living in Long Beach. Where we were living is by design. They would complain every day. They're happier now, but they used to complain every day. Where we live is by design. The fact that we are here together is by design. It's the good hand of God on our lives that's guiding us and saying, I've got you here for a reason. I've got you here for a purpose. Okay? So So that's the first thing to mention. Secondly, Nimrod. Nimrod is a picture of those who are looking for an earthly kingdom, that rebellion and strength may be honored by people, but it's never honored by God. We look at mighty warriors, people that are strong, and we go, man, that is one powerful dude. God sees the exact opposite of that. Rebellion, the Bible tells us, is as the sin of witchcraft. Witchcraft? Those who dabble in witchcraft? Those who dabble in the occult? Those who dabble in demonic activity? Rebellion is as the sin of witchcraft, which means simply this. If I know there is something right to do or good to do or directed by God to do, and I choose not to do it, this is a spirit of rebellion. Yes, I am choosing to rebel against the Lord. And the Lord views that rebellion as the sin of witchcraft. Is that a serious thing or not? When God tells me to do something, I need to be as obedient as I know how to be with whatever God is saying to me. Otherwise, I am treading on dangerous territory. Do we want to hear the truth in church or just stuff that tickles our ears? The truth is, we need to walk in obedience to God, because anything other than that is rebellion, which is as the sin of witchcraft. Now, sin never just impacts the person, but it impacts the lives of so many other people. We see the impact of his life has affected us till today. We're still reaping the consequences of the sins of this man's life even today. What he did, what his wife did, and the lie that they propagated is still being circulated today. But regardless of man's rebellion, God's will on earth will be done. Regardless of rebellion, God's will on earth will be done. What do you mean? Israel witnessed this when it came to Pharaoh. Pharaoh knew that God was speaking to him, right? Because it was one sign after the next, after the next, after the next. And eventually he was getting really tired and saying, okay, go. And then he would change his mind. And then he would say, okay, go. And then he would change his mind. And we'll see that when we get to those chapters. Okay, take the people and go. Only pray for me. Take the people and go. Only don't go too far. And then he would keep changing his mind. So he knew the Lord was speaking to him, but he kept rebelling against, he kept hardening his own heart against God. He was walking in sin and rebellion. But here, Israel witnessed that even though Pharaoh was rebellious, God's will prevailed. Despite man's bad choices, God's will on earth is going to be done. And as if to say to the Israelites, God has a plan, sin attempts to get in the way, God overcomes and always prevails, but the rebellious ones are the ones that miss out. What is Moses writing to them here? He's saying to them, be careful. Be careful, because you have an option. You have an option to either be obedient to the voice of God, who wants to take you from the wilderness and take you into the promised land, or you can rebel. And if you choose to rebel, God's will is still going to be done. But you're the ones that are going to miss out. So be very, very cautious. Did they learn their lesson? Did they learn their lesson? No. No. Last point to reference here is that there were 70 families that are mentioned in that tree. There are 70 families that are mentioned there. So I read 70 names to you tonight. Sorry. And he's careful to only mention 70. It doesn't mean that there were only 70 people, but he's very careful to only mention those specifically. Because 70 has a sacred meaning in the Bible. It's made up of two factors, of two numbers. 7 represents completion or perfection, and 10 also represents completeness and God's law. How many commandments are there? 10. If you recall, there were 70 elders that were appointed by Moses. And when he was reading the covenant in Exodus chapter 24, it says he took 70 elders and they went up and they had a lunch with the Lord. They sat down and they ate and they saw God. That's Exodus 24, verses 9 through 11. Later on, There would be 70 elders who composed known as the Sanhedrin. Jesus sent out 70 disciples. It's also a sign of judgment. When God judged the nation of Israel and they were caught up into Babylon, they were caught there for how many years? 70 years. And so 70 speaks of the Israelites under Moses, because a total of 70 Israelites ended in Egypt around the time of a man named Joseph. Joseph was in Egypt, and he brought his family, he brought his dad, and he brought his brothers and all their little ones, and the total number of persons were 70. So why is Moses writing 70 people in that list? Because he wants them to make the connection. He's saying there were 70 of you, and there's 70 here. And if you don't understand your history, you're going to repeat the history over again. You need to understand that God is reigning supreme. You need to understand there's something called rebellion. And if you do, God is still going to fulfill his promise, but you won't be a partaker of the goodness of that promise. I don't know about you, but I don't want to be that kind of Christian that makes it to heaven by the skin of my teeth. What do you mean? No crowns, no rewards, no nothing. Why? Because I didn't do what the Lord told me to do. I can do a lot of Christian activity and look good in front of other people, but that's not what matters. We can even begin to pack out the church and people begin to applaud you. Right? Oh, you're doing great work. Yes, yes. Praise the Lord. Yes. You're on missions trips and you're on TV and you're doing this and you're doing that. What did God say to do? That's the important thing. What is the Lord saying to do? I need to be in tune with what God is saying to me to do specifically, because when it's time for me to give an account to God, I'm not going to be judged based on your perception, but on his commandments. So here there were 70 names listed, and there were 70 that came out of Egypt, and now there are people of over 2 million. And so the 70 then becomes an encouragement to them. He wants to encourage them. An encouragement to them that their ancestor Shem was chosen by God as an act of grace. He was saying, you didn't do anything to deserve this. It always begins with grace. For by grace you have been saved through faith, and that not of works, lest anyone should boast. It is an act of grace. And so God is the one who exalts. It's never by birthright. Because was Shem the firstborn? No, Japheth was. It was Japheth, and then Shem, and then Ham. So typically in the old cultures, and sometimes even still today, it's the firstborn that gets the double blessing. Yes? And he's saying here, it's not by birthright. God is the one who exalts. And it's not who society believes deserves the blessing or the honor. But God delights in the small, the forsaken, the forgotten, the younger ones. That's who God delights in. God has a specific choice for Israel to be his chosen people, through which the Messiah would eventually come. And the promise of God for the descendants of Shem and for Canaan would be their servant to help them in conquering the land of Canaan. And God wanted Shem to be a light. He wanted Israel to be a light unto the nations, and for the nations to come under the covering of that light, the covering of that salvation. So, all of this is preparing the people of God to understand the season ahead of them into their promised land. Because basically what he's saying is, it's not Nimrod, it's not Pharaoh. Later on, it won't be Nebuchadnezzar during the time of Daniel. It won't be Artaxerxes in the time of Esther. It won't be Herod in the time of Jesus. And it won't be Caesar in the time of the apostles. It won't be any of these rulers that can stop you or thwart the plan of God in your life, no matter how strong or how powerful or what your opposition looks like. Listen, it doesn't matter what your opposition looks like right now. It doesn't matter what the obstacle, how big, how strong the obstacle is right now. No matter what it is, when God has a plan set in motion, he will fulfill that plan in motion, because God is the one who knows how to raise up and how to bring down. He knows. If you will just but trust him, if I will but just trust him, Because he tells us that no weapon formed against you will prosper. No weapon. So long as we trust in the Lord. And he concludes with this, or we'll close with this verse here tonight from Deuteronomy chapter 7, which we'll get to in about 7 or 8 years. Deuteronomy chapter 7, verses 6 through 8 says, "For you are a holy people to the Lord your God. The Lord your God has chosen you to be a people for himself, a special treasure above all the peoples on the face of this earth. The Lord did not set his love upon you nor choose you because you are more in number than any other people, for you were the least of all peoples, but because the Lord loves you, and because he would keep the oath which he swore to your fathers, the Lord has brought you out with a mighty hand and redeemed you from the house of bondage, from the hand of Pharaoh, king of Egypt." What is he saying? He's saying, I chose you. I have a purpose for you. And there is nothing that anyone can do to stop my purpose from fulfilling. You are a holy people, he starts off by saying. Were they holy? In practical terms, were they holy? No. Positionally, were they holy? Is there a difference? Absolutely. Positionally, in God's eyes, they were holy. Meaning what? Meaning he had separated them. So they were holy unto the Lord. They were consecrated unto the Lord. They were separated unto God. So they were holy. But in practicality, were they holy? They chose not to be holy. They chose to rebel against the Lord. And the Lord has chosen you to be a special people, a special treasure above all the peoples on the face of this earth. Do you and I dare to believe that for us today? Do we dare to believe that for us? That positionally we are a holy people unto the Lord. He says, be holy, for God is holy, because he is holy. Yes? And you and I are a special treasure for him. Because he was that one who decided to sell everything when he found that one pearl of great worth. And he went and purchased that one pearl. I believe it's in chapter 13 of Matthew. And bought that one pearl of great price. And when he found it, he went away rejoicing with exceeding joy. Why? Because he found the most valuable thing that there was to find. And he was willing to sell everything for it. That everything is you and me. That everything is you and me. Do we dare to believe him? Do we dare to say, God, I choose to believe you because your will and purpose will be fulfilled on the earth no matter what I choose to do. And if you don't fulfill it through me, you'll fulfill it through someone else. And God will. When he couldn't fulfill his purpose through Saul, he found David. Yes? When God doesn't fulfill his purpose through one person, he finds another person to do what the first person refused to do. So God will get his purpose accomplished in the earth. The question is, do I want to be a part of it or not? And I think it's based on faith and simply trusting him. And when I hear his voice, I say, I'm not going to rebel against you. I'm not going to be involved in the sin of witchcraft, but I simply want to yield to you and be a part of that blessing. And I'm going to choose to believe that I am holy unto the Lord. And I choose to believe that I am a special treasure unto the Lord. And whatever you want to do in my life, in my weakness, use me as I am. Take the broken parts of my life. Take the broken pieces of my life. Take the confusion in my life. Take the inconsistency in my life. Take whatever you need to take in my life and use that for your glory, because you are more than able. You are a purposeful God. Can we take a moment to pray? God, I thank you because you are a very purposeful God. Nothing you do is by accident. Nothing you do is by mistake. Everything you do is with perfect intentionality. Thank you for that. Thank you that you looked at these Israelites and you said to them, they're a holy people. And as we read through the scriptures, Lord, we see that they're not holy. They were rebellious, but you loved them. You wanted to bless them. And you purposed to bring the Messiah from their lineage. Lord, I trust that there are blessings that you want to bring through our lives, Lord God. And you want to reveal Christ through our lives to others. That your purpose will be fulfilled. You will accomplish that which you have set out to do, Lord God. I just pray that you would give us the faith and the grace and the humility to trust you, to walk with you, to obey you in everything, the big and the small. Thank you, Jesus.